This weekend, the movie The Social Network opened across the country. The film is a fictional account of the creation of Facebook, and it paints a pretty dark portrait of founder Mark Zuckerberg. While the film may not be entirely true, NPR's Laura Seidel checked in with some Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to hear if they thought it rang true.
The critics keep saying that the film doesn't make the founder of Facebook look very good. The Zuckerberg in the film has some petty motivations for starting his company, trying to prove himself to girls and to the establishment at Harvard. But from the perspective of people working in Silicon Valley startups, the Zuckerberg in the film is a role model and a hero.
When people do big things, there are problems along the way.
26-year-old Ash Rust is an engineer at Clout, a company that ranks individual influence on Twitter.
I don't think that any revolution has been completely clean, and this was a communication revolution.
But more importantly to Rust, Zuckerberg is portrayed as a man with a vision.
So I think they did a very good job at capturing the emotions and energy of an early stage startup. People don't sleep, but when they do, they dream of a kingdom. 500 million people, the entire world connected in some way through your product.
The film moves back and forth between the creation of Facebook and the proceedings of two lawsuits against Zuckerberg after the rise of his company. In one of the cases, two twin brothers from Harvard charge Zuckerberg with stealing their idea.
People are very possessive and protective of this one idea they had in the bathroom one day 5 years ago.
That's how it is in the movie, but that's not how it is in the Valley, where people are always throwing around ideas, says Rebecca Huang, an engineer and one of the founders of Unoodle, a company that uses mathematical formulas to predict the success of startups.
We feel for people like Mark, who put in the sweat and the blood and the time and the effort to make it happen.
Zuckerberg definitely comes off as hardworking and obsessed in the film, but there's also a lot of partying, drinking, and drugs. This group of entrepreneurs finds that picture a little bit exaggerated.
There's beer in the fridge.
Yeah, that's about it. There's a lot of caffeine. Red Bull.
Most of the women in the film are model beautiful, and they are usually partying and having a good old time. That's not quite the real women in Silicon Valley Jim Ying knows. He's with social gaming startup Six Waves.
I definitely thought that the portrayal of women in it was, whatever, it's sensationalistic. It's definitely kind of skewed and stereotyped.
But hey, says Ying, that's Hollywood. Ying thinks if this film was meant to be a morality tale to discourage people from being like Mark Zuckerberg, it's likely to fail the same way that the original 1987 movie Wall Street did. A movie about greed became an inspiration for an entire generation to enter the financial world.
I'd be curious to see if people who are somewhat inclined to start startups see this as this is a cool way to kind of live your life. They might not be kind of pulling out the morals that this is not a cool way to start a business.
But in Wall Street, the main character, Gordon Gekko, declares greed is good. In The Social Network, Zuckerberg becomes a billionaire, but money isn't what drives him. He wants to change the world. That makes him a hero for a generation that sees its revolution in social games, faster video, and mobile computers. And as a nation, we've seen a lot of fallout from people motivated by greed. So the motivations of this generation may seem like an improvement. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Finally, I wanted to have a word about the tragic death of Tyler Clementi, the 18-year-old Rutgers University freshman who apparently killed himself after discovering that his roommate had broadcast over a webcam a sexual encounter Clementi had had with a man. The roommate, Darren Ravi, and another freshman named Molly Way, also 18, have both been charged with invading Clementi's privacy. The death has sparked grief, as it should, and outrage, as it should. But it has also sparked many questions. Is technology a factor here? Is sexuality? Now, let me say at the outset that my heart goes out to the Clementi family. As a person who has only recently received one of those phone calls you never want to get, I understand the desire, the fervent hope for an explanation that helps it all make sense. But those of us not touched directly by the immediate tragedy must resist the easy answer, because there's too much at stake and too much to learn. Right now, the dominant narrative reads that technology has nothing to do with this, but that the sexuality of the deceased somehow does. In other words, would the roommate have been so quick to broadcast the sexual encounter had Tyler Clementi been intimate with a woman? The activists have weighed in to say no, but my guess, and it's only a guess, is that he would have. Now, I know that members of beleaguered minority groups are very eager to have the majority understand all the ways that they are at risk because they are members of those groups. And I also know that Clementi's death came in a short period of time when several other young men around the country also killed themselves, apparently because of taunting about their sexuality. Still, I am skeptical that disdain for Clementi's sexuality was at the heart of this. I suspect that what was at the heart of this was that Clementi was perceived as an innocent, and that was confusing, challenging, and perhaps even infuriating to somebody who was probably himself an innocent. And I say that because a cynical and knowing attitude about sex is all the rage. The cool pose, the pose of single-minded pursuit of sex without feeling or attachment, is so assumed, so accepted, that one who is without it might as well be standing naked in the street. And so I strongly suspect that Clementi's roommate put Clementi's business in the street in part out of jealousy and perhaps resentment that he was not the fellow naif he assumed him to be and perhaps even hoped he was. And this is where I suspect technology does play a role. I used to joke that kids today think it's in the Constitution that everybody will be a television star at some point. And the new spate of reality shows shows every sign that that has come to pass. People with no talent, save the talent for making a spectacle of themselves, are deemed worthy of our weekly attention. So much of technological innovation has outstripped the moral code to regulate it, and thus too many people have become convinced that relationships are a matter of performance art. Why else do young people send underdressed pictures of themselves to each other, videotape their sexual exploits, and broadcast them on social media? Now, adults, tisk tisk. After all, technology is to many adults like a foreign country to a new traveler. They may visit often, but their accents will always give them away. But adults have little to complain about, given that they are the ones who have lionized people like the stars of Sex and the City, made them rich and famous for removing their clothes and simulating sex acts for all of our viewing pleasure. Meanwhile, there's no conversation about love and intimacy. The public discussion lives in a narrow band, from the conservative no, stop, don't, to the liberal whatever, whenever, and with whomever. So it strikes me that many of us are implicated in this awful death. Certainly those two who set the thing in motion, but also all of us who have kept silent while sex has been turned into a commodity because we don't want to be uncool. We all died a little last week. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Our TV critic David Bianculli recently looked ahead at what the networks had to offer for the fall season. Today, though, he's looking back, way back, half a century or more, and he's wondering why some TV programmers aren't doing the same.
That music may not conjure up any memories for you, especially if you're under 30. But to most older listeners, ones about my age, that's instantly recognizable as the theme song to TV's My Three Sons. It's a tune all but guaranteed to start your toes tapping. And it may even conjure up long dormant images of the animated opening credits where cartoon toes were tapping. There's value in these old shows, not just because the best of them were and are entertaining, but because they provide a snapshot of what we were, what we accepted, and what, in some cases, we aspired to become. I mention this not because of a general wave of nostalgia, but because of a very specific wave. Last Wednesday, My Three Sons, a gentle ABC sitcom starring Fred McMurray as a single father raising three boys, turned 50 years old. I would say it celebrated its golden anniversary, except I couldn't find any celebration. Not on ABC, which wasn't about to waste valuable prime time on a show that premiered before the oldest person in the network's coveted 18 to 49 demographic was even born. Not on TV Land, which you'd think would be a natural, or even on Nick at Night. No, even on cable networks devoted to vintage TV, vintage, these days, means the George Lopez Show. And I'm not kidding. My Three Sons, by the way, is by no means an isolated case of TV disregarding its own past. Last Sunday, CBS's The Andy Griffith Show, one of TV's most durable, popular, and iconic weekly programs, turned 50. TV Land, at least, showed a four-hour block of episodes that day to honor the event, but it made sure the celebration was over before primetime. The Flintstones turned 50 last week, and only the Boomerang cable network seemed to care. ABC's Beulah, the first TV sitcom to star an African-American, turned 60 last weekend. But not even BET bothered to present an episode. And yesterday was the 60th anniversary of the delightful game show hosted by Groucho Marx, You Bet Your Life. And I bet your life you didn't know that. Next month is the golden anniversary of one of the most important TV documentaries ever shown, Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame, about migrant workers, originally shown Thanksgiving weekend on CBS. It's been out on video for years, but if no one sees it, that's the same as being lost and forgotten. The same goes for a show that turns 60 next Tuesday, a CBS series that was the pivotal missing link between vaudeville, radio, and what evolved into the TV sitcom, The George Burns and Gracie Allen Show. This was when George Burns was relatively young. TV, too. The stage sets of George and Gracie's house had only three walls, so studio audiences could see the stars. Mentions of the commercial sponsor, Carnation Evaporated Milk, were folded right into the show's dialogue. Gracie, effortlessly bringing to TV her radio role of a ditzy dame, would wonder how they managed to get milk from carnations. But the central DNA of television situation comedy is all here. The neighbor who bursts in unannounced, the schemes that don't work, the husband who thinks he knows best but often doesn't. And after 60 years, the comedy is still funny. For example, the scene where Gracie visits a friend in the hospital and returns home with a bouquet of flowers. And yes, they're carnations. It always gets a big laugh from the college students in my TV history class.
Why, what beautiful flowers.
Aren't they lovely? And if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have them.
Me? What did I have to do with
this? Well, it was your idea. You said when I went to visit Clara Bagley to take her flowers, so when she wasn't looking, I did.
Gracie. I said for you to stop.
Well, isn't it good that carnations there? I'll put them in the refrigerator. We'll milk them later.
We'll milk them later. Well, I guess if she made sense, I'd still be selling ties.
So where is this going to be shown on TV next week? So far as I can tell, nowhere. And that's a shame. For movie fans, Turner Classic Movies is the perfect cable network. It shows films unedited and uninterrupted and has a host on hand to put things in context. It even has a weekend showcase called The Essentials, where Robert Osborne and guest host Alec Baldwin present certain movies and talk about why they love them. Where's the TV equivalent when more programs are celebrating key anniversaries every year? If we forget our TV history, we're doomed to no repeats.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll tell you about Blogalicious. That's another event going on this weekend here in the U.S. That one's aimed at making the blogosphere look more like America, with much more color and gender diversity. That's later. But first, 200 million viewers.
That's how many people China's Yang Lan reaches every month. She's known as China's Oprah Winfrey for the massive, massive media empire she has built. And that's why she happened to be in Washington this week. She was invited to Fortune magazine's invitation-only Most Powerful Women Summit, along with CEOs, politicians, and religious leaders. With Yang Lan in Washington, we wanted to take the opportunity to introduce you to one of China's most famous women. She is the co-founder and chair of the Sun Media Group and host of the television program One on One. And in that capacity, she has interviewed such high-profile guests as Hillary Clinton and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. Here she is putting Kobe Bryant through some tough questioning during the 2008 Olympics.
Since 2002, the U.S. team hasn't been performing very well on the international stage. And sometimes people even say the dream team is now a nightmare team. Of course, there's certain exaggeration in this, but what does that mean to the current American team? Are you ready to win back the respect and honor of the American team?
I hope so.
And now I get to turn the tables and interview Yang Lan. And thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Michelle, for having me.
How sick are you of the Oprah Winfrey comparison?
Well, I like her a lot and also respect her work and contribution to the society. And most of all, it's the inspiration for young women, you know, to realize their dreams, whatever it is.
Do most people in China know who Oprah Winfrey is? Does that comparison have any meaning transnationally?
Well, for those who have exposures to Western media, yes. But not the majority of the population.
They would say she's the American Yang Lan, right?
Could be, yeah.
In fact, we were talking before, as we were just getting settled, about this Most Powerful Women label. And I would like to ask, what do you think about that label being described in that way?
Well, I'm not very comfortable about the power thing, because power used to describe the more, you know, male chauvinism kind of value system. I think nowadays women are breaking the borders or the boundaries and also try to give a new interpretation in terms of the impact you can have to the society. It's not about the matter of the scalability or the massiveness of how many people you employ or how much money you can decide on, but it's rather it's the new thinking that you can bring to other women or to the society as a whole.
What impact do you think that your programming has had on China? And I just want to mention that for people who are not aware, one of the things you're known for is innovating a style of programming that was quite new in China and also was quite new in its time in the U.S. I mean, they actually were developed along parallel tracks, an idea of programming that was directed at women that took them seriously, mm-hmm. Both as people who think and as people who consume and who have a central role in the culture. So I would like to ask, what role do you think your programming has had?
Well, I've been basically doing two shows. One is Yang Lan One-on-One, which is 10 years old now. I've interviewed more than 600 movers and shapers across the world in politics, business, arts, culture, and society. My other show, Her Village, is a weekly women's talk show. It's a combination of Oprah Winfrey show with The View, because I have two other partners, two hostesses, much younger, and one of them is a Korean girl. Of course, we have celebrity guests too, but also we have ordinary women coming in to share their stories. So we help to bring to the light different lifestyles and different life stories of women and try to connect with them and also express our own views.
How has that been received? And you mentioned the diversity, the ethnic diversity, which has not always been present in programming in many countries, inviting people of different ethnic backgrounds to share their views on an equal footing. And I wonder how that's been received.
It has been received very well because the Korean girl, as I introduced her, she has been living in China for a long time. She's engaged to an American guy who is in the marketing business for sports in China. And he proposed on the show to her, which made my other partner, the other hostess, crying because she just broke away from her former relationship.
Oh, no.
So it was very emotional, and a lot of drama in it, but it was happy.
I did want to ask, though, there is a way in which the we've talked about all the change in China over the last sort of two decades, sort of the opening up of so many restrictions. I do have to ask, though, as one person in the media to another, are you really free to say what you want to say, to cover what you want to cover?
we still have some regulations, censorships. But another fact is that the internet has provided a great public arena. And for the last few years, we see more and more often that public opinions will drive public policies and drive the government to be more transparent and open. So we see the progress of freedom of speech.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with talk show host and media entrepreneur Yang Lan. She's here in Washington at a summit for the world's most powerful women. It's hosted by Fortune magazine. One of the other things you share in common with Oprah Winfrey is that you were one of the ambassadors for Beijing's bid for the Olympics. Of course, it turned out a little better for you than it did for Chicago, but we won't dwell on that.
But we failed the first time in 1993.
Still hurts. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that your other program is One-on-One.
Mm-hmm.
You brought America to China in many ways with, you know, interviews with people like Bill and Hillary Clinton, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and
Jimmy Carter. George Bush, the senior.
And Kobe Bryant. Which of these tend to be more interesting to your guests? And does it ever surprise you what it is that people respond to and what they don't?
Well, people want to know, you know, these political figures or celebrities' personal life and also their journeys to what they are today. Well, I was invited to Honey Bunkport to visit George Bush the Senior's home, and he and Barbara showed me around their old house.
Now, I have to say that I covered that administration for 4 years, and I was never invited to that house. So I'll try to contain my envy, but thank you. Continue.
Well, that was...
Is it nice?
It was very nice, and they were very cordial. And so because he served as the representative to Beijing a long time ago, and also he was known as the ambassador on bicycle because he bicycled around Beijing at that time, the Chinese audience certainly relate to that kind of memory and like to know a part of their, you know, personal lives.
If you and I were to get together again in 5 years, you're still very young. I mean, by mogul standards, I mean, you know, it's particularly, I mean, you've been at this for quite a long time. And I'm wondering if you and I were to get together in 5 years, what do you think we'll be talking about?
Well, we'll be talking about women. I'm very curious to witness the historic transformation of Chinese women. You know, for example, my grandmother, who passed away last year at the age of 98, was born in the year of 1911. And when she was growing up, her generation was still too bound feet. And the girls were illiterate totally and were kind of supporting roles in the family to their husbands and their children. And then my mother became the first college student in the whole family as a girl. And we look at the way we have been through. It's like compressed history within the past century. And I'm very curious to find out the transformation of this generation of Chinese women and see what they can achieve. Not just in China, but also, you know, across the borders.
Yang Lan is chair of the Sun Media Group and host of the Chinese television programs One-on-One and Her Village. And she was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios while on a visit to Washington. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, everyone.